The responsibility for propagating and defending the concepts of Christianity belongs to every generation of believers. We are commanded in 1 Peter 3:15 to give an answer, and the word means a reasoned answer, for the hope that is within us. We are to have the capacity to answer the intellectual currents of the day and the spirit of the age with good biblical divine viewpoint. Yet many Christians seem to be content to compartmentalize their faith. It's sort of a save it for Sunday type deal. As if you can divorce God and life and daily experience. Sundays I'll walk by divine viewpoint. Monday through Saturday I'll walk by human viewpoint. Many Christians would be content to live in a vacuum. We talk about hothouse Christian schools, but often we have hothouse churches. Believers feel threatened by the unregenerate world, and consequently they clam up and ask God to put them in a vacuum, so to speak. They're like soldiers who are content to live in warm quarters with good rations, lounging in the barracks while the Lord's enemies occupy and capture the field, which is the world. In this century, Christianity has come face to face with an idea, a worldview, a way of life called scientific socialism. It's not scientific, but that is one of the words that is worshipped in this age. So it utilizes the word. And in 65 years, scientific socialism has swept over one half of the world. It has garnered over one half of the world's population to its faith. Consequently, it becomes a pastoral responsibility to challenge the concepts and the ideas of communism for Christians, to help them think through the concepts of this faith, this religion, that is such a challenge in this age. There was a man once who said that once an idea has found its age, once an idea has found its time, it's very difficult to stop the idea. And the idea of scientific socialism has found its day, and it is conquering the world. We have an answer to this, and I want to help you think through what the enemy is thinking. And this is my purpose over these past few weeks. One Christian, well, I don't know if they were Christian or not, one person that was here got angry because I stated dogmatically that most of the leaders of revolutionary communism had religious backgrounds, which means that somewhere along the line they had to reject theism. They had to reject orientation to God to adapt their view. And in the context of that, I mentioned McGovern, that George McGovern had a religious background. He had a fundamentalist father who was a Methodist preacher. I'm sorry about that, but that's the way it was. He was a Methodist. It's like the Methodist preacher that was talking to the little kid, and he said to the little kid, are you a Methodist? And the kid says, no, I'm not a Methodist. And the preacher says, well, what are you? He says, I'm a Baptist. He says, well, why are you a Baptist? And the kid says, well, my father's a Baptist, my mother's a Baptist, my grandfather's a Baptist, grandmother's a Baptist. So I guess that's why I'm a Baptist. So the preacher very wisely said to the kid, well, what if your parents had been a fool? What would you have been? The kid scratched his head and said, I guess I'd have been a Methodist. Tags don't mean much. I could label that piano Steinway, but it's not going to fool anybody. Now, when Dick Berg plays it, it sounds like a Steinway, but that's a dinky rinky dink. Couldn't have found a better rinky dink. It's a collector's delight. I mean, if a collector ever sees that, it's gone. Labels. It's what's behind the label that counts. It so happens that George McGovern's father was a Bible-believing Methodist. Now, he probably was full of legalisms and so on, but nevertheless, he accepted authoritatively the Word of God and the deity of Jesus Christ and the substitutionary death. Somewhere in George's life, he had to reject that, and he has rejected it. He's a liberal. He's the delight of the National Council of Churches. He was on their committee for race and relations for a number of years, etc. Somebody says, well, why do you mention that in church? I mention that because you cannot divorce the absolute personal God from your personal life. Truth has become personal. Truth has become personal in Jesus Christ, who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And everything God wants us to know about himself, he has made manifest in Jesus Christ, who is the way, the truth, and the life. You can never be neutral to truth. You don't come to church on Sunday morning and throw it in low, and then on Monday through Saturday you throw it in neutral. Not if you're orienting to God, you don't. And I name George McGovern because I believe he's a socialist. I believe he believes in scientific socialism, which I believe is anti-Christian and anti-biblical. And what I say about him, I can document. Well, that starts it off. I knew I was in shock. We are taking a month to spend on communism, and the month's almost up, so we better get going. We are talking about the concepts and teachings of communism. We're not dealing with superficial issues. We're dealing with what revolutionary communists believe. We are dealing with that which motivates revolutionary communism. And I'll just repeat to bring us up to date, because I wasn't here last week. Communism finds, I'm expressing this a little differently now, it finds its buttressing bases. It finds its buttressing bases, B-A-S-E-S, plural, in the 19th century anti-supernaturalism. In the 19th century anti-supernaturalism. Which is at once anti-theistic, as the Bible defines theism. It is anti-theistic. The three basic ideas that we dealt with were uniformitarian geology, biological evolution, and socialistic evolution. Now, if you are here as an unbeliever, and say, let's just say you happen to stagger into this place somehow. You moved into the neighborhood, and you happen to come here, and you are a trained geologist. And when I make a statement like this, that uniformitarian geology is anti-scriptural, and you are a trained geologist, you're liable to turn off right away. But I'd like to have the opportunity to talk to you personally about uniformitarian geology from other believing geologists' point of view, to challenge what you've been taught. And I don't have time to go back over this now. We would be wasting other people's time, but I'd just like you to know that. If you're a doctor and you believe in biological evolution, I'd like to have the opportunity to talk to you about it, the implications of it and what it means. We don't have time to do it publicly, so if you'd like to, I'm open to talk. Then we dealt with four basic presuppositions of the communist revolutionary mentality. All right, the first of these was that there is no God. There is no God. Hence, I'm expressing these just a little bit differently than what we did in the past. Hence, religion is a tool of oppressors.
Point two. Economic forces, by virtue of the dialectic, or a dialectical process in history, economic forces, by virtue of the dialectic, determine the course and the end of history. Now, this was Marx's great contribution to the communist theory. Karl Marx took the materialism of Feuerbach, one of his teachers. He took the materialism of Feuerbach. He took the dialectic of Hegel. And he made a world view out of them, a concept, a philosophy of history that is called economic determinism or dialectical materialism. We spent the whole Sunday on dialectical materialism. This is the basic faith of communism. It is a metaphysical concept. It is a belief. It is a trust. It is an assumption. It is a theory. But nevertheless, it is the faith. It is a presupposition that is not true, but has some apparent truth for it, as does all false systems. In marrying Feuerbach's materialism with Hegel's dialectic, Marx made his contribution to communist thought. He brought to communist thought and to a materialistic worldview initiative, purpose, motivation, and devotion, simply with that dialectic. It's very, very important to understand that. Communists understand, trained communists understand what they believe. And they are looking with great hope to the future as to what their concepts are going to accomplish. Last time we met, we talked about three aspects of this. Progress, retrogression. Sometimes the line does not go straight up. It goes up and then moves back, but it's always going up. And there is a socialistic evolution in the world that cannot be stopped. This is a basic faith of communism. Now, to show you, I don't know if I used this illustration, but if I did, I'll use it again because I won't hurt anything. To show you how naive we think of the communist mentality, in 1959, Nikita Khrushchev was invited to the United States. Now, the information that was made public as to the reason for the inviting of Nikita Khrushchev went something like this. We'll invite Nikita Khrushchev to the United States when he sees our vast affluence, our homes in suburbia, when he sees how many cars we have and our television and our gigantic industry in the United States. He will be shaken to the core in his faith in the communist dialectic. Now, that was our thinking. That is naive and foolish. Nikita Khrushchev, when Nikita Khrushchev came to the United States and he met Alan Dulles, who was in charge of the CIA, he shook hands with Alan Dulles. He says, "Oh, good morning. I'm glad to meet you. I read your report yesterday." He says, "In fact, half of the spies that work for me work for you. I know them by name." He says, if you and I could get together, we could probably share our reports and we'd save a lot of time." That's what he said to Alan Dulles. How naive of us to think that Nikita Khrushchev doesn't know about the material prosperity of the United States. And yet in our thinking, that's what publicly was the public reason for inviting him to this country. Let me tell you something. The communist doesn't live for the now. He lives for the future. He believes that there is an inevitable course of history that is determined by economic forces in the world. And that end is inevitable. Okay, I've been over that so many times. I hope you've got it. We're ready now for a new one. The third of the basic presuppositions of the communist mentality. Number three. Men and women are the highest stage of animal life. Now, they don't stop there, however. They go on to say, but they are perfectible. Now, we men, we always knew that men were perfectible. We've had doubts about the opposite sex, but... In other words, what the communist is saying is that evolution is a process that perfects man. Now, they add to that, however. They add to that the concept that force will quicken the pace of perfection. Okay, let me repeat. The communist mentality believes that men and women are in a higher, are the highest form of animal life in existence. They believe this because they accept the evolutionary hypothesis in toto. They also accept uniformitarian geology, the twin sister of biological evolution. Now, they are not interested, however, in this slow process of evolution. They want to speed it up, and so they use force or violent revolution. And by violent revolution, they will so prepare the environment that the perfectibility of human nature will become more rapidly. Now, there's an interesting switch in the basic concept from Marx to Lenin in this idea of force. Here is Marx and here is Lenin. Lenin says, Marx says, force is the midwife to the old society in the birth of the new. Okay, let's get the old society. Here's the old society, and she's pregnant. The old society comes into a clash. Now, see, the communist believes that there are certain stages of history. We're in the last stage of history now, the bourgeois stage. The old society, in terms of the current day, would be bourgeois. Bourgeois means the middle class controls society. But it is in conflict with the proletariat. The proletariat is the poor worker and the peasant. And these are in clash. Now, the thing, see, this has been the thesis. This is the antithesis. They are an opposite poles, and out of that has to come the synthesis, or the new baby. And the baby is the synthesis. Now, to Marx, force was simply the midwife that looked to the old society and watched it, and right at the right time, when it was about to give birth to the new one, the midwife stepped over and forced it a little bit. Now, Lenin takes that and he changes it. Lenin takes the idea of force and he says that force is not the midwife but the mother of the new society. So that here is the old society which has within it the potentiality of a new society, and the only way it will be mothered is violence. Now, see, this then is an illustration of one of the this concept of force in the dialectic, in the betterment of society, in scientific socialism, is illustrated in the division between China and Russia today. Russia is now in a revisionist concept of violence. How long they'll be in it, we don't know. They could change any minute. That's why it doesn't pay for us to have our guard down. That's why it doesn't pay for us to stop our defense budget or to limit our defense budget, like George McGovern wants to do. We don't know how long Russia will do that, but they are now in a revisionist concept, and they have gone back to Marxist concept, where communist China is following the Lenin concept. And consequently, when they get together, they argue. They say, we're Leninists. You're revisionists. We can't go along with you, etc. Okay. Now, when we talk about these theories, You always have to identify practice. What happens actually in practice? Let's go through the theory, the communist theory and the practice. What we see in theory and what we see in practice. In other words, to read the books and to read the theoreticians like Marx or Lenin or Mao, to read what they say in theory and to see what is practiced, we're going to find are two different things. So theory would be how it would go or how it should go. How it should go. And remember, Marx wrote long before the revolution ever came. The practice is how it has gone. How it has gone. Okay, first of all, they believed in revolution, all of them. First of all, you had to have revolution, even if revolution was only the midwife. Whether it's the mother or the midwife isn't necessary. Marx felt that once the revolution started, it would be inevitable that it would be immediately worldwide. Okay, Marx is writing in the 18th century. He publishes Das Kapital in 1857. He writes the Communist Manifesto in 1848 with Engels. So almost 18 years pass before he adumbrates on the Communist Manifesto. By the way, they were so sold on biological evolution. Darwin wrote his book in 1859, at least it was published in 1859. That when Marx wrote Das Kapital and had it published, he wanted to dedicate it to Charles Darwin. But Darwin had read the Communist Manifesto, and consequently, he could see that these men were revolutionaries. And even though he believed in evolution, he didn't want it to come about by revolution, so he refused to have his Das Kapital dedicated. He wouldn't let Marx dedicate it to him. When Marx was buried and Engels gave the funeral oration, he said that Marx had done to social thought what Darwin had done to biological thought. You cannot separate these concepts. They go together. You young people, when you go off to college, you are immediately going to be challenged about what you believe about the Bible. How are you going to defend intellectually what you believe if you don't know any doctrine? You see, the Christian believes that there is a God. But that God is not content to be some absolute other. He is involved with his creation. He not only created, but he also reveals himself to his creation. And he has spoken to men in time and in place in history. Moreover, he has had men to speak for him. Moreover, he has had his words recorded so that men might know him. He is a personal, he is an absolute God, but he is personal. And above and beyond that, he has appeared in the person of Jesus Christ. Now, this is our basic presupposition. We believe this. We have historical fact to point to. We can defend what we say on that basis. Whether other people accept it or not is not the issue. It's whether or not we can defend it and give a reasoned answer for the hope that is within us. That's why you must interact with intellectual concepts of your day and fight them, challenge them, and not relegate concepts to Sunday morning, Sunday evening at church. Okay, Marx knew that there would be a revolution, but he felt that it was inevitable that once the revolution broke out, it would spread around the world right away, because all the workers of the world would rebel. Well, the revolution broke out in Russia, and there hasn't been too many revolutions since then. He thought immediately in the United States all the workers would rebel. But what he didn't take into account was the intelligence of business people in America to begin to deal with the problems of labor. There's only one country in the world that has ever elected a socialist leader, and that is Chile. And in the last election, Allende was
elected to be the president of Chile. Chile has a government similar to ours. Once you get a man like that in office, then he can bring pressure to bear on various forces, particularly economic forces in the country. Allende has already nationalized the copper industry in Chile. In other words, he took private enterprise that was owned mostly by Americans, and he says, the Americans are taking all the money out of Chile. Now, we're going to nationalize the copper industry. We're going to keep it, keep the money in Chile. And, of course, all the Chileans would say, amen, go to it. But now Allende is threatening the small businessmen of Chile. So bad that last week, last Monday, the small business people went on a strike in Chile. They're Chileans, they're not Americans. They went on a strike. You know what Allende did? He sent out all of his undercover men, and they went around taking down the names and addresses of all the businesses that were on strike. So he can bring economic pressure. See, then he can accuse the small businesses of upsetting the national economy and causing problems for the working man, and then he can nationalize all small businesses. Of course, once he does that, they're done. Because most small businesses are in such a mess, it would serve him right to take them all over. It's like the communist Chinese leaders, trained in Washington University, trained at Berkeley, trained in the United States. No wonder they think the way they do. They've gone to graduate schools and haven't had any challenge. The thought of graduate schools. Most graduate students, they just worship everything the professor says. All right. The theory is that there'll be a revolution. Out of the revolution, second, will come a dictatorship of the proletariat. A dictatorship. Now, notice the way this is expressed. It is of the proletariat. And the proletariat are the working people. These are the worker peasants. In other words, they'll be in control. Thirdly, in practice. Theory. I'm sorry, this is in theory now. The reason in theory that we have to have a dictatorship of the proletariat is because there's too many ignorant people in the country. So what you do after you establish this dictatorship is you educate for life. You educate for life. Which means all children become pawns of the state. Whatever the state wants to teach them, they teach them. And your children then are not ultimately responsible to you, but they are ultimately responsible to the state and the good of the state. And hence you cannot teach them something contradictory to what the state wants to teach them in the schools. You are not allowed to teach them religion. You're not allowed to teach them your faith. Communism is mind control. It's a matter of the mind. It's an attempt to control the mind. Consequently, out of this you will have erosion of the state. Erosion of the state. See, once you have the super brains thinking for you and teaching you how to think and what to think, once you have that accomplished, then you won't need any more state. You'll have a gradual erosion of the state, and you end up in the fourth stage of communist theory, the communist society. Communist society. And the communist society is classless bliss. Classless bliss. Pie in the sky in the sweet by and by. Utopia. No government. This is called the miracle of communism. Now, of course, somebody asked Marx how long it would take from this stage to this stage. See? How long is this going to have to take? He thought it would be very, very rapid. Lenin thought it would be very, very rapid. We are now in about the 52nd year of a communist state in Russia. The workers' paradise. One of the greatest things that could ever happen to the American working man would be to go visit. He wouldn't have to go visit Russia. Just go visit any foreign country. India or someplace like that. America is a utopia compared to other countries in the world, materialistically speaking. And Russia is far from the workers' paradise, because over here, this is how it's gone. How has it gone? Number one, you had revolution.
Now, it happened that the revolution broke out in Russia. Only instead of having a dictatorship of the proletariat, you now have a fascistic dictatorship. And I use that word advisedly. It is a fascistic dictatorship. It is a dictatorship of the Central Committee. And that Central Committee, the Presidium, is an authoritarian monopoly in Russia. They tell people what they can do, where they can go, when they can quit their job, etc., whether they can leave the country, and so on. In other words, what actually happened was, in Russia, in practice, in exchange for a czarist dictatorship, they now have a Central Committee or a Presidium dictatorship. Now, out of that has come a dictation of what the general will should be. A dictation of what the general will should be. Always with the concept that you do not have the capacity to know what it is. You do not have the capacity of what to think. You have to be told by the state. And the result of that, instead of being the erosion of the state, as the theory teaches, you have state capitalism. State capitalism. You work, you earn a certain basic pay, but the profit of your labor goes to the state. You have a bureaucratic structure in Russia that is more firm than the capitalist classes that we have in America. It is more difficult to break than the capitalist class that you have in America. Now the question is, where does it go from there? See, instead of classless bliss, you have state capitalism. And where does it go? It can only go to one place, and that's disillusion. And the intellectuals in Russia are now sensing the disillusionment of scientific socialism. Russia is not a worker state. It is a state capitalistic society. And all communists try to get around this by identifying their practice with socialism and their goal with communism. In other words, they'll say, we now have socialism. That's this. And we're headed toward communism, where there is no socialist state. But it doesn't matter what kind of label you put on it. They now have a state capitalistic system under a dictatorship of the Central Committee. Economic determinism, in which the state is predestined, or the economic elect. All of this revolves around the concept. See, all of this goes back to the idea that individuals can be perfected if you properly arrange the environment. We don't see it happening, however, in practice. The fourth presupposition. The fourth presupposition of communism and the communist faith. From the original promise that, or premise that there is no God and that men and women are only animals, it's just one more simple step to reject ultimate morality, right and wrong. And the fourth presupposition is that all morality is temporary. All morality is temporary and relative. All morality is temporary and relative. There are no absolute standards. A communist believes that standards of morality are simply reflections of the class systems under which we live. I want to read a statement by Lenin to document this. Lenin stated very simply his concept of morality under a class system. In what sense do we communists deny ethics or morals? In the sense in which they are preached by the bourgeoisie, which deduces these morals from God's commandments. Of course we say that we do not believe in God. And we know perfectly well that the clergy and the landlords and the bourgeoisie all claim to speak in the name of God. But they do this in order to protect their own interest as exploiters. Now you see, he's speaking from a framework of thinking that is molded by Russia. And in Russia you had a state church. And one of the evils of the state church is that everybody in the state has to contribute to the state church. So if the leaders of the church get their dole from the state, then they are going to be subservient to the state, to the landlords, the people that are paying their bill. See that? And they were. They were profligate priests in a state church. It's one of the evils of the state church system. That's why it's great to have Bible churches, where you don't have a denomination. You don't have headquarters sending any money. You know, some of you people come from denominational backgrounds. And it's just unbelievable to you that this church could function on the basis of grace. We don't have any headquarters. When we get in trouble financially, we don't call up somebody in Atlanta or down in Texas. We don't have any denominational bosses telling us what to do. And it's unbelievable to some people who have been raised in denominational to actually believe that a church can function, much less pay the pastor. Particularly when they pay the salary they pay me, which is fantastic. I had a man call me up this week. He's in a liberal seminary, liberal Presbyterian seminary. He came here one night this summer. He just stopped by. And he called me up and he says, I've got to get out of this liberal seminary. He says, what do you think I ought to do? And I says, well, first of all, you got to forget about the denominational machine. You don't need it. You'll never be the man for God that you could be in a denominational machine. That's true of everybody. And God's going to take care of you. And once you, and God had to bring you to that decision in your life where you're going to turn your back on a denominational machine. He was raised in it. Of course, that's the way he thought. We don't need a denominational machine. The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, seeking to show himself strong in behalf of those whose heart, whose frame of reference are perfect toward him. Why depend on men when you can depend on God? But when you're raised in that machine, the church is in trouble. We need a new organ. Let's call up the bishop. Let's get some help from the denomination. We need a new building. How much will the denomination kick in? See? Now, Lenin is speaking of an evil that was real. The priesthood in Russia was controlled by the state. It still is controlled by the state. It is still paid by the state. The metropolitan of the Eastern Orthodox Church in Russia lives in an apartment in the Kremlin. That's not hearsay. I talked to a Baptist preacher from Russia who told me who was in the party with him when he was here in 1961. It's not hearsay, it's real. The Baptist happened to be an evangelical. He didn't have an apartment. So when he says that these claim to speak in the name of God in order to protect their own interests as exploiters, he's telling the truth. But then to take that statement and apply it to everybody in the world is false. Going on with a quote. Or instead of deducing their ethics from the commandments of morality, from the commandments of God, they deduce them from an idealistic or semi-idealistic phrases in substance were always very similar to divine commandments. We deny all morality taken from superhuman. See, there is your denial of any supernaturalism. We deny all morality taken from superhuman and non-class conceptions. We say that this is a deception. We say that this is a swindle. A befogging of the minds of the workers and the peasants in the interests of the landlords and the capitalists. From this starting point, Lenin goes on to make the point that standards may be kept or broken. He says, quote, we say that our morality is wholly subordinated to the interest of the class struggle of the proletariat. Repeat, our morality is totally subordinated to the interests of the class struggle of the proletariat. We will say anything in the interests of the class struggle. Our morality is totally relative to the success of violent revolution of the proletariat. We deduce our morality from the facts and needs of the class struggle or the proletariat. A communist is a master of the principle, the end justifies the means. In the Berkeley incidents, there was a woman who was an undercover agent of the FBI. She infiltrated the movements at Berkeley. Somebody told that woman, she was not a Christian, somebody told her about a Bible doctrine class in a home in California. She went. She became a believer. She was fighting communism from the basis of politics. But when she came to be a believer, she came to look at it in a totally new perspective. But she tells in the tape, we have it somewhere, we used to have it, she tells how they were trained at Berkeley, if they had babies, to take the babies up in front of the police lines so that the babies would be certain to get hit, so that the empathy of the American public would be attracted to the revolutionaries in the Berkeley uprising. She tells them that. Why did they do that? They do that because they believe in a class struggle. And they believe that they'll do anything in order to attract attention to the class. How can they bomb buildings and so on where people are bound to get killed? Well, it doesn't matter because it contributes to the class struggle. And the fact that a human's life is taken, that's immaterial. It doesn't matter. This is how a revolutionary thinks. How can Rene Davis and A.B. Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, how can they go on a campus and tell college kids, you may have to go home and kill your parents? Well, these statements are documented. I'm not making this up. How can they do that? They do that because if that will contribute to the success of the revolution of the proletariat, they're for it. Let's go a step higher. We have a man that works for Hughes Aircraft in our church. He's an aerospace engineer. And he has a friend that went to communist China to help them set up communications with a satellite when Nixon was going to be there. I guess it's the communication media is still there, the various machines and so on. And he met engineers, of course. He had to work with engineers for 2 months. And all the engineers asked, he said, they were very, very well-trained technicians. They asked excellent technical questions about the electronic data that they were setting up in communist China. But one day they got in a philosophical discussion. And they said to this engineer from Hughes, what is your purpose? And he was dumbfounded. He says, what do you mean? What do you mean, what is my purpose? They said, well, what are you here for? He said, well, I'm just here to show you how to set up this stuff so you can have communications. And they said, no. What is your purpose in life? And he couldn't answer. He didn't have a purpose. This is not the man from this church. This is a friend of his. So he threw the question back at him. He says, well, I don't know. He says, what is your purpose? And to a T, bar none, every one of them said, our purpose is to free the proletariat, the slaves of the world, the working class. We are working to the end. Our whole lives are dedicated to the freedom of the proletariat. And there are no absolute standards in that struggle. We are playing a game with 2 sets of rules. I like to play golf. If you're playing golf with a communist, you tee off, he tees off, and he'll probably slice out in the woods because there aren't any good communist golfers. You've noticed that, haven't you? They can't stand the competition. Communism breeds mediocrity. There are no good golfers in China, and they're not good enough competitors. But anyhow, I'm playing golf. So he slides off in the woods. He goes over there and hacks around and finally gets the ball out, hits it in the sand trap, gets it up on the green while I'm putting out. So I go to mark the scorecard and I Say, I had a 4. What'd you have? He said, I had a 2. You had a 2. Yeah, I had a 2. Well, how do you figure? He says, well, we divide by 2 in Russia when we play golf. He wouldn't tell me that, but that's the way he came in his golf. You play by 2 sets of rules. Imagine trying to sit down at a bargaining table with a man who has no standards of morality. There aren't any absolute standards. Imagine trying to make a military agreement with a nation like that. We've made 25 since 1948. They've kept 1. If you have any brains at all, if you have any sense, if you know what's going on, it makes you fearful when Richard Nixon says he's going to Russia to bargain with the Reds. Healthy fear is the basis of survival. Unhealthy fear is the basis of paranoia. But you can't survive without a healthy fear. And we are dealing with a people whose frame of reference is totally different than ours. They do not accept our ethics. They smilingly pretend to use our terms when they mean something else entirely. A communist is an international sociopath. He has no ethics. Now, what we have been considering in actuality turns out to be the worldview of the communist mentality. Attempt to explain history with one eye closed and 50-50 vision in the other. It is a totally deficient, defective, and lopsided view of history. Moreover, it is a worldview with basic metaphysical presuppositions that are totally inaccurate. For example, economic determinism, the concept of economic predestination, is a faith, not a fact. The idea that progress is inherent in change, that is, social predestination, is a metaphysical presupposition. It is not a fact. Some changes have been for the worse. The idea that people are perfectible is a presupposition, a faith. It is not a fact. The concept of the evolutionary concept of evil. In other words, what is evil? Evil to a communist is the same as evil to a liberal in America. A religious liberal in America believes in ethics, but not dogmatics. He believes in evolutionary ethics, ethics related to the situation, struggle with the strong surviving and strong concepts surviving, etc. That's why liberalism, theological liberalism in America, is the breeding grounds for political liberalism. And theological liberalism in America is the source of 1970 problems in America. And if you say Merriman's attacking anything, you tell him, you just say he's attacking theological liberalism, because that is the root of our problem. We made a choice around the turn of the century. Our seminary, individuals made choices. And they accepted religious liberalism, and they rejected the God of the Bible. And the problems that we are facing today with our young people and so on are simply the outcome of that. And some of our young people see the issue better than the adults do. Why wait for the sweet by and by? Let's have it right now, honey. The answer is in Christianity. I hope you'll come back and give me an opportunity to defend that. We have the answer in Christianity. The answer is not in politics. The ultimate answer is not in politics. The answer is in the God of the universe, who is true and personal and has identified with us. And truth has become so personal that you can't separate it from God and from Jesus Christ, who is the way, the truth, and the life. I hope you'll come back and give me an opportunity to present the Christian side to this whole problem. Shall we pray? Now, Father, help us by your Spirit to understand this worldview of revolutionary communism. Help us to see past the facades and manifestations to the functionings of the minds of people. And help us that we will not be jellyfish-type people who have no answer, no reason, no logical answer for the hope that is in us. Oh, God, forbid that that would be true of Holly Hills people. Stimulate us by your Spirit to know the Christian answer, that we might challenge on every opportunity the spirit of the age. In Christ's name, amen.